Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, listeners. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. We're up to episode 28. I'm back from yet another holiday, and Scott, another marvellous introduction, consistent, Scott, and good to be with you again.
It is good to be with everyone, and thank you all for tuning in to us.
Yes. So thanks again to the 12th man for stepping up to the crease last week and helping out.
Yes. It's something he enjoys.
Yeah. So, okay, lots to tackle tonight, Scott.
And there is.
Yeah, so from all over the globe, but close to home, we've got Clive Palmer.
Yeah, you know, it's always peculiar to me when you've got business people that talk about the importance of free markets and that sort of stuff until something goes wrong in their own backyard. And then it's like, oh, the government's got to help, you know?
Classic, yes. Like, it's the mining industry in itself is always, you know, you've got to build these railways and these roads and these port facilities for us.
Yeah.
So that we can extract this stuff. But, you know, don't tax us.
And, yeah, exactly.
And, you know, the gall of this man, like, I have despised him since he popped up on the radar because he's just, he's so clearly, you know, the Donald Trump of Australia.
Yes, that's a very good way of looking at him, yes.
And the people of Fairfax who voted for him, shame on you, I say. Shame, shame, shame on the people of Fairfax if you could not see through that facade of jovial Uncle Clive, for goodness sake, out to help the battler. Like, shame on you, the people of Fairfax, for foisting him on us for so long.
Well, I mean, yeah, they've sentenced us to him for 3 years.
Yes.
Fortunately, you know, the political people that examine the entrails have all said that he's finished, that there won't be anything left of them afterwards. You know, so Fairfax is, they've given us to him, he's a one-hit wonder, and that's the end of the story, really, where it goes. I mean, it's just phenomenal to me, this accusation that, you know, the books of the Queensland Nickel Industries showing how much money he's actually given to his own political party.
Yes, well, $20 million in the past 2 years.
Exactly.
And as recently as December, declared another $290,000.
Yeah, now that was declared on December 31. He claims it happened before that, you know, that $290,000 donation happened well before the money problems actually set in.
Yes.
You know, as to whether or not that's right or wrong, I don't know.
Yeah.
Having said that, though, I mean, you know, I'm a bean counter, and I find it hard to believe that you would not see something like this coming.
Of course you should see that you're on shaky ground. I mean, he has no record of operating anything successfully. I mean, he bought a football soccer club, and that was a disaster.
Yeah.
He bought the Coolum Resort, and that was a disaster. And he's bought the nickel refinery, and that's a disaster.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's just parlayed a real estate sort of business into mining and got lucky in a sort of a Nathan Tinkler sort of way. But when it comes to actually operating something, he's just been terrible. So
yeah, he has been terrible, yeah. But, you know, it's and then on top of all that, like, you know, we've got there's from the ABC, there's another Clive Palmer refinery taxpayers face multi-million dollar bill to clean up Queensland nickel site.
Well, you know, this, this is the thing. When he bought that nickel site, it had a clear problem with a sort of not a tailings dam, but some sort of dam that was just full of nasty stuff.
Well, I mean, you must have to... No, I can't find it. But there was talk of tailings dams up there, so it must involve some sort of chemical process when you refine the nickel.
Yes.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, you've got estimates here ranging from 25 million to 300 million to clean it up.
Yes.
So we'll take the BHP estimate and say that's about $100 million to clean up the site.
Yes.
So, you know, it's still a hell of a lot of money.
Yeah. I mean, that's why... Well, that's why BHP got rid of it in the first place. And, you know, this is a dangerous sort of precedent. If you're someone like BHP and you've got a massive environmental problem that, you know, could cost $100 million to $300 million to clean up, the fact that you can just sell the business to some two-bit operator like Clive Palmer and he goes bust, and then the community is left, you know, paying the cost on that. Like,
yeah,
I reckon if there's some clear and obvious environmental problem on a property and you manage to sell it, those proceeds should be held in trust or something pending the cleanup because of the danger of something exactly like this. Clive Palmer runs it into the ground, extracts money out of it for his political purposes, and then lets the thing collapse, and with it the liability to fix up the environmental damage. So, if you have an environmental problem, just, you know, sell it to some two-bit operator at a discounted price and let him go broke, and there you are, problem solved.
Well, that's what it looks like, doesn't it?
So we should be looking at laws where there's an acknowledged environmental issue that somebody just can't sell it, take the money and run like that. So
anyway, I agree.
It'd be interesting to see if any of the people in power take up that idea. I don't think they will, but you never know.
Well, I don't think they will, but you never know. Exactly.
Yes. So next on our agenda, we've mentioned before our new border force.
Yes.
It used to be our friendly customs people, and
we
had that incident in Melbourne where they were going to go round in their black uniforms and their jack boots.
asking people for their papers.
like the Gestapo in a bad movie. And at the time we said, I said, I don't like those uniforms. They just make them look like some sort of fascist Gestapo hit mob. And lo and behold, what we found now is the amount of money that the Immigration Department is spending on medals.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the militarisation of the Immigration Department.
Yeah, it's amazing.
They have spent, can you believe, on medals, $1.3 million this year.
Well, it's over 3 years, but still in all, it's an amazing amount of money that they're planning on spending. $440,000 a year for the whole thing is what they're going to be spending on medals.
What?
Now, the office of the official secretary of the Governor General is the government body that typically spends the most on medals and awards, about $2.2 million in 2015. So you would expect that, because they've got the Australia Day honours and that sort of stuff that they've got to hand out things for.
Yes.
But you would then expect the next biggest spender would be defence.
Yes.
And
they've spent less.
They've spent less.
Yes. So
significantly less, yes.
In 2015, over 8 contracts, they spent $300,000.
Yeah.
It's
amazing that you've got for want of a better term, a tin pot bloody government department spending $440,000 a year.
It's just crazy. There are people sitting in an office somewhere earning ridiculous money saying, oh, yeah, let's just hand out medals for this and this and let's get the most expensive ones we can get and let's get it from the most expensive supplier. Like, it just is outrageous. And there is a comic which I'll post maybe as part of this podcast where this guy is pointing at another guy with all these medals and he's saying, what's that one for? And he says, stopping the boats. And that one, stopping the boats. And the other one, stopping the boats. And as he looks down at his chest full of medals. And like, when I travel overseas, Scott, and I have been doing a bit of that recently, you know, you go to these other countries and the surly immigration people at the United States of America are enough to make you want to go somewhere else. And often in other countries, it's a pretty ordinary PR exercise by the customs people. And I find, coming into Australia, in and out, they've always been very friendly, and I like that about the Australian customs. Like, you know, a bit of a joke with you and just a efficient, casual friendliness about them. And exactly. I really resent them being now dressed in the black uniforms
having bloody jack boots. Having a chest full of medals.
Yeah, so it's
ridiculous.
It's un-Australian is what it is, Scott. So that's just absurd. So let's, you know, mark that down as another absurd thing that's happened in Australia. Next on our agenda, this one a bit more local, perhaps for Queensland people, but we've got state Liberal National Party who are in opposition in the state in Queensland. Current leader is Lawrence Springboard, and he's been a bit quiet and some would say hasn't been doing much, hasn't been laying many punches on the current Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk. So they're talking about maybe in the new year there'll be a challenge to his leadership and the potential, well, the man most likely is potentially Tim Mander, who is a former NRL referee.
Yep.
And my problem with him is guess what?
He's a Pentecostal Christian.
That's it. He's one of these. He's an evangelistic character, and he worries me. I mean, there's no way we're going to get a watering down of the, you know, the way that religion's in our education system in Queensland if he has any power.
If he has anything to do with it, no, you won't.
We can just...
I mean, even if they have to borrow the money, whatever they will, even if the feds see light and they knock the national school chaplaincy program on the head.
Yep.
If he becomes premier, he will find the money and he will keep the bloody thing going.
Yes.
You know, it's just amazing.
Yeah. He worries me. I mean, for me, as a secularist, the most important thing we can do is get religion out of our schools. And,
yeah, great.
That's the biggest issue, and he will be the biggest stumbling block to it. So if, you know, if for no other reason, I would be, you know, if there's no secular party candidate in the state, in my area, I'd be going Labor rather than the LNP for that reason of Tim Mander.
Yeah,
so, anyway, this article that we've got a link to makes an interesting point. Talks about Tim Mander. First thing it says about him is NRL referee. And then it says, this is interesting. Secondly, Mander's evangelical Christianity also appeals in regional Queensland. Often unrecognised by the urban political commentariat, there remains in Queensland outside the Great Southeast an ingrained and residual piety that crosses denominational boundaries. It includes everyone from Roman Catholics with their 19th century Irish Catholic and 20th century Italian roots to contemporary Pentecostals. And it says, this underlying rural religiosity was a key part of Joe Bjelke-Petersen's political appeal. And we saw a glimpse of it in the support for Kevin Rudd in 2007. It's ebbing away with the passing of time. It is not easily tracked by opinion polls, but it still exists. And I think that's right.
Yeah, I think that is right. I mean, it is amazing. You know, I mean, I'm from regional Queensland. I grew up in Toowoomba. And, you know, there is certainly an amount of religiosity that just doesn't go away.
Yep.
You know, it's not going anywhere quickly.
And it seems possibly more so than other states.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I agree.
So anyway, that's developments in Queensland state politics. And moving about as far away from that as you can possibly get, we shall go to Pakistan, Scott.
Yeah, wasn't that incredible?
Do you want to tell that story? I mean,
yeah, how warped is the religious mindset in Pakistan?
Pakistan,
we got a 15-year-old boy who chopped off his own hand to show how devout he was after people wrongly suspected him of committing blasphemy. The story goes that what happened was that he was at for want of a better term, a mosque.
Yeah.
But I think it was an outdoor, basically, gathering and that sort of stuff. And the imam asked the question, who doesn't pray?
Yes.
And he put his hand up.
Yes.
So clearly he wasn't listening or something like that, and he put his hand up. So as a result, the crowd then turned on him and accused him of blasphemy.
Yep.
So he went to his house and cut off the hand he had raised, put it on a plate and presented it to the cleric.
Isn't that just awful? He's mistakenly thought, you know, who does pray, put up his hand. The crowd's turned on him and he's a very religious kid anyway, and he's gone home and he's chopped his hand off and gone back and presented it.
Yes.
And, you know, Scott, I thought this can't be true. Like, this is going to be one of these fake articles that this can't be true. I mean, for a start, how is a kid going to chop off his hand? Like, how do you do it? Like, you can't sort of, you know, hold a knife to yourself long enough to get through the bone or whatever, physically to do it. And I Googled around and unfortunately found an article where a BBC correspondent went to the village in Punjab province and found this boy. And the way he did it was his dad had a machine in his. Let me just find it here. He had a grass cutting machine, and there's a picture of the machine on this link that I've got on the. So he could just put his hand and let this machine do its nasty business and chop his hand off. Like,
God!
And it says here. I came back home and went to the grass cutting machine, but found the place dark. So I took my uncle's phone to point some light at my hand. I placed it under the machine and chopped it off in a single swirl. He picked up his severed hand from under the machine and, bleeding profusely, placed it on a tray and took it back to the mosque less than 100 metres from his home. And then he's passed out and he's taken to hospital. And the thing about this, like, it does go on to say that he was very devout. The thing about this is he is being congratulated by the community in Pakistan.
It says it in the article that I'm assuming you'd be putting up on the site. It's so much worse that everyone applauded his actions. It's the sort of response that will only encourage more of this ridiculous behaviour in the future. And it really will encourage people to sever parts of their body and that sort of stuff, you know, to prove that they are devout.
I think it will.
Yeah.
I think
it's madness.
It's just the most sickening thing that these people are so brainwashed that he can actually chop off his own hand and everyone else cheers. I mean, in Pakistan. I mean, goodness me, the mind control that religion has over people. And, you know, refugees and whatever end up in the West, and we wonder why we can't get on, because we are coming from completely different worlds. Oh my goodness.
Well, we certainly do look that we are coming from completely different worlds.
Yeah. So,
you know, I refer you to last week's podcast where me and Paul discussed the thing in Cologne.
Yep.
You know, and it really is different worlds.
Yes. So, yeah. So that is shocking and just so sad. Anyway.
Now, before you dive into the Domino's pizza.
yes.
Anne and Craig and that sort of stuff. We had a small debate. You'll probably have to edit this out. We had a small debate about this penalty rates for Sundays.
Oh, yes.
And that sort of stuff. Yes, yeah. We had a small debate about this last Sunday when we were at the meeting.
Yeah.
And the consensus of opinion, now it wasn't consensus because Joe was on your side.
Yes.
But the others were saying that to back away from having Sunday trading and that sort of stuff was to give in to the religiosity of the whole, you know, to go back to the church having dominance over your Sunday.
Well, yeah. when I get back to that meeting, Scott... and reopen, that'll teach me a lesson. That'll teach me for having yet another holiday and missing a secular party meeting. But I'm sure once I've explained the concept fully, I mean, nobody thinks of penalty rates in a religious sense. I don't think, in Australia. Well, they don't see it as a religious day. They just see it as Sunday.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. However, when this was first floated some time back, I remember I said at the time when you asked me the question, I said, you know, well, you know, I don't have a big problem with it because it's Sunday and that sort of stuff, and, you know, we should treat weekends as just weekends.
Yes.
But then the next thing that came to mind was, well, the people that are getting penalty rates are the lowest paid.
Yes.
So,
I mean, yeah. I don't have a problem with, you know, we celebrate Christmas as a holiday at that time of year, and I know you have a different feeling about those sort of holidays, but I don't have any problem to say, well, that's what we're set up to do at that time, and we don't have to believe in Christ to enjoy Christmas, and we don't have to believe in the church to enjoy Sundays, in my view, and... Okay, well, forewarned is forearmed. I shall have my arguments ready and see if I can sway opinion on that one. But, well, that's interesting. So we won't edit that out. We'll leave that in. It's, because my
that's fair enough.
My son complains that there's not enough disagreement with me on this podcast anyway. He thinks we need to introduce people who are just going to argue. So that's good to know that some people disagree with me anyway.
Well, they disagree with us, and you know, I still think that we've got the right position on the penalty rates.
Yes,
but you know, it was an interesting point of view that there was arguments coming from others that said that if you, Anne in particular, said that if you get that situation like you had said, if you can't afford to be open and that sort of stuff, and remain closed. She said, well, then we get to the point that businesses will close and that sort of stuff. And I don't have a problem with businesses not opening on a Sunday.
Yeah. And, you know, if a business can't pay its employees properly, then it's not a legitimate business.
Yeah.
Speaking of which,
I shouldn't agree. Yes.
What a great segue then is a link to Domino's Pizza. I mean, you see the ads. I've never bought one in the last... I don't think I've ever bought one. Like, I just don't like that sort of pizza. But...
No, I tend to agree.
But, you know, it has crossed... it has come across my radar at different times how incredibly cheap it seems to get pizza delivered to your door. Yes. And you think, how can they do that? Well, the answer is by not paying people properly. So... So I've got a link I came across in my inbox, I get this thing, you know, inviting me to sign online petitions at different times.
Yes, and, yes.
And this one is in relation to Domino's Pizza. And the father of one of the Domino's employees has started up a petition on change.org. So they've got lots of petitions at different times. So, so on it, he's describing the rates of pay for the delivery drivers in Domino's Pizza. And Scott, I'm going to have to edit this out because I'm clicking on this damn link and it's not coming up for me. So,
no, really?
have you got it printed out there?
Or? Yeah, I've got it printed out there. So look, the delivery drivers for Domino's are paid below the minimum wage. My 19-year-old son is paid $14.51 per hour for 2 hours per day, plus $2.27 per delivery. He has to pay the cost of running his vehicle out of the $2.27, so per shift he is paid, after expenses, about $30. So in total, $15 an hour.
Mm.
If he was paid the minimum wage, he would work for 3 hours at a pay rate of $18.98, plus 41 cents per kilometre for the vehicle use. So he would earn, after running costs, about $60 for 3 hours.
Yep.
You know, it's... it's pretty bloody criminal, really.
I mean, $60 for 3 hours isn't a lot of money, you know.
No, it's not a hell of a lot of money anyway, but it's still better than
$30
for 2 hours.
You know, $30 for 2 hours, and always with these things, you've got, you know, we can't do anything the half hour beforehand because you've got to get to work, and the half hour afterwards, like, it's doing a 2 hour shift is a crappy shift in any business, like. You've barely got started and you're going home again. All of the wasted time to-ing and fro-ing. So I've got, you know, you're supplying your own car and working for 2 hours for $30. Like,
yeah.
And apparently this is all done under some workplace agreement signed in 2001, so 15 years ago. And that just shouldn't be allowed. So I don't know how, you know, these things should expire or they should challenge it or whatever. But anyway, there's a link on the website to this petition. And if you think a Domino's driver should be paid more, even on a Sunday, and sign the petition, I reckon. Like, you just click on stuff and off it goes. Easy to do. And maybe if you do buy a Domino's pizza, then just tip the delivery driver because he's getting, he or she is getting bugger all to deliver that pizza.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah.
So, so that's how they're doing that. Next up, we're crossing all over the world here, Scott. January 23. Does everybody know the significance of January 23?
It's the 5th Annual International Day of Protest Against Hereditary Religion.
That's correct. So,
yes. So January 23 is not only this Saturday, yes.
So there's a link there, basically protesting and raising awareness about the fact that kids are just indoctrinated into religions from an early age without any respect for their rights to perhaps be left alone till they're adults. And
yeah, agreed. You know, I mean, that's the that is the main point, is that, you know, the decision to join a religion is a decision best left until a child is a mature adult.
Yeah.
But institutionalized religion has been unwilling to acknowledge that children have religious freedom rights. You know, it's very true. You know, you've got kids that get indoctrinated right from when they're little kids, and then they end up believing nonsense all their life.
So as part of the thing, they've got different events on, and there's a contest, a meme contest, which expires on the 21st of January, and this will probably not be uploaded until late on the 20th of January.
21st of January, yes.
So you're going to have to be a really prompt podcast listener if you hear this and are inspired to submit a meme. You're going to have to work really quickly. Otherwise... get one ready for next year.
Yeah. When it's the 6th Annual International Day of Protest.
Indeed. So, Now, Iceland. Did you guys talk about Iceland in my absence or
no,
not?
No, we didn't. No.
Okay.
No.
So,
but it's very interesting numbers that have come out of there, isn't it?
You didn't talk about Zooism at all?
No, you know, we didn't.
Okay. So, basically...
Yes, we should have done.
Yeah. In Iceland, there's basically a system of automatic tithing. So, tithing is where religions take your... You know, Mormons are famous for it, for example, that 10% of your income you're supposed to give to the church. And they would have that set up that you just make your payment direct to the Mormon church. But in parts of Europe, the government actually gets involved. And in Iceland, they would take 10% from you automatically as part of your, like, your tax through the government and send it off to your religion. And you had no real other option until people have started arcing up against this, and these people kicked off their Zooism religion, which is actually supposedly one of the more ancient. I mean, there's been thousands and thousands of religions, so they just picked up an old one out of Greek mythology, I think. But they said that in its modern-day incarnation, they didn't want money from their followers and they would refund the 10% that the government collected for them. And this, of course, created a lot of converts to Zooism.
Exactly. You know, and it's no wonder. I mean, if you could be a member of a Zooist church, you know, and then you just get your tithing back. I mean, that's just,
crazy that you should have to do this.
It is crazy. Yeah.
But so that was sort of in recent weeks has happened in Iceland, and now I have a link to a poll which was done in Iceland, and this had an amazing result. They're asking people how they about the creation of the world to see whether they were, you know, creationists believing in God or whether they believed in the Big Bang, and. For people younger than 25, the poll found that 0% believe God created the world.
Yeah.
What a great statistic. So 93.9% said it was the Big Bang.
Bang,
and the rest were don't knows and zeros for believing God. Mm. What a great statistic.
Yeah, it's a very powerful statistic. It's... you know, it says that Iceland's moved on.
Yep.
That they are a secular nation. You know, it's the end of the... Well, Zooism and that sort of stuff is simply just the... You know, that's just the reality of secularism.
Yes.
That's just people turning around saying, well, bugger you. You know, you're not going to keep them on money.
Yep.
And they've joined up into a false religion.
Yes. Yep. Mm. So, interesting place, Iceland. Their response to the global financial crisis and other stuff was interesting as well. We may talk about that another time. But, you know, this this whole notion of the government taking your money and sending it on to the church, I mean, this isn't just some crazy Icelandic tradition. Like, this happens...
No, this happens in Germany.
Exactly.
Germany, definitely. I'm pretty sure it happens in the Netherlands, too.
Yes. You know, so I've got a link.
These are modern democracies.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
So I've got a link there just to an article that sort of confirms that. And and yes, so in Germany, they will take your 10% as part of the tax system and remit it to your church. So you have to formally exit from the church in order to stop that happening. So amazing that this happens in this day and age. So there you go. Iceland and Germany. Previously, Scott, we've mentioned the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster.
Yes.
And the followers known as Pastafarians.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, a good shout out to Joe, who's a regular listener.
Yes.
He's a Pastafarian.
He is. I'm thinking of joining. I'm really liking the sense of fun that these... I mean, you have to ridicule, I think, religion to sort of just show its absurdity.
Well, I mean, the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster was started in the United States 10 years ago by Bobby Henderson, who first wrote an open letter protesting about the teaching of creationism in school.
Yes.
You know, that's how it all started, and now it's got to the point of being recognised as a religion.
Yes. So we mentioned previously that in New Zealand, they successfully applied to be a recognised institution that could conduct marriages.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, inspired by that, the Australian... Can you say the Australian arm of the Flying Spaghetti Monster? The Australian...
the Australian wing? Yeah, the Australian...
Tendril?
I don't know.
Yes. Anyway, they've applied to see if they can get similar respect here in Australia, and good luck to them. We'll be following that closely, and I'm sure Joe will let us know how that goes.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
Yes, but I'm just reading here. That was about New Zealand, but Simon Cuthbert is an ordained...
That's a very familiar name.
Okay. He's an ordained minister of the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. And he said that although it was born out of satire, the church has succeeded in acquiring a serious status around the world. And he goes on, he's quoted here, "We have a supreme being like any other religion," Cuthbert said. "Wonderful carbohydrate, there's some protein there as well, but he's an all-seeing, all-knowing type God who doesn't discriminate against anyone. You can be straight, gay, transsexual, Catholic, atheist, it really doesn't matter." He said members could be gluten intolerant. You just can't eat the meaty parts, he said. That's fine. And just the final bit here. The spaghetti monster doesn't want to be basically put up on a pedestal. He just believes that everyone should be treated the same. There's ones in there about how we should be allowing people who want to be together to just be together. A few other quite humanistic values there. So yeah, good on you, Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, for your quest for recognition in Australia. But still on that topic, I didn't think I'd ever get two Pastafarian things in the one podcast. But
no, you never thought you would. But still,
yeah. The other thing that they've become famous for, the Pastafarians, is having their driver's license taken with their colander on their head.
Yes.
We've mentioned that before. And in Russia, this government officials weren't happy about having to photograph people with colanders on their head. And so what they've done is deputy head of the department, Vladimir Kuzin, told a newly licensed Pastafarian, Andrei Filin, and he's pictured with a yellow knitted strainer on his head, that if he ever gets pulled over by a cop and he's not wearing that strainer, his license will be revoked. So in Russia, they've said, if you're going to get your photograph with a goddamn colander on your head, you better be driving with one.
Wearing it while you're driving, yeah.
Yeah, which is unfair on two levels, Scott.
Yes, here we go.
Well, one is, you know, what if you decide to change religion after you've had your license taken? I mean, that happens from time to time. I mean, you might decide...
It happens quite frequently, yeah, yes.
You know, I mean, driver license photos last a long time now. So, you know, he should be allowed to change religions if he wants to and not be penalised. And the other one, of course, is that I distinctly remember that the Australian guy who had his photograph taken made the observation, I thought it was a joke at the time, but it was probably a clever move. He said that he only wears the colander on formal occasions. So I think you could argue that having your photo taken was a formal occasion, but just regular driving is not. So if you are Pastafarians out there thinking about getting your license with your colander on your head and you're worried that down the track there might be this Russian sort of response, at the time, I think you should just declare that you only wear it for formal occasions.
Yeah, and you just make the point at the time that you know, you're licensed photograph is a formal occasion.
Yes, and tell them that was your legal advice from the Iron Fist. And,
yeah, exactly.
See how you go with that. Now, it wouldn't be a podcast without the quick mention of the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yes, it's amazing that the World Bank's gone in and done a report on it all, and they have concluded that Australia gains almost nothing from the mega trade deal with the 11 other nations, including the United States, Japan, and Singapore. And on top of all that, we've exposed ourselves to these bloody
investor-state dispute state, settlement yes. clauses. Yes.
One of these days, I'm going to remember it. Yes. You know, it is amazing that I think it was 0.4%.
Point,
wasn't it?
By the year 2030, it will have boosted the Australian economy by
0.7%. Yeah. The U.S. economy, actually, this is the thing that did make it, which I did find rather funny. The study said it would boost the U.S. economy by only 0.4% by 2030.
Well,
so, you know, it makes you wonder why the hell the Yanks were so bloody keen to get the damn thing signed up, because they're not coming out of it smelling like roses.
Well, perhaps the World Bank has taken into account that all of the U.S. multinationals who will benefit from this actually send their money to Ireland and Singapore and places like
true,
that.
Yeah.
And those countries aren't even, well, I don't know if Singapore is, but Ireland isn't even party to this TPP, and they'll probably be the ones who benefit the most because the multinationals will send all their money there for low tax. And there you go. So, I know we haven't heard anything about it. Like, it just... there's nothing in the news about this. And I know that the whole country has closed down for virtually 6 weeks for Christmas. And
yeah,
there's no politics.
But, I mean, you know, politics is just starting to come back now. Surely something this big, it really should be discussed.
It's just worrying me that this is kept so low profile that it could just sneak through without too much discussion. And we'll just be saddled with it forever. It's not like you can just, new government comes in
and walk away from it.
It's got clauses in there that you're bound for, years to come, like it or not.
Yeah, agreed.
So hopefully Australian mainstream media picks up on this because not much has been said.
No, that's right.
So that's Trans-Pacific Partnership. We are just crossing the globe all over the shop here, Scott. Interesting article I found about the massive immigration in Europe causing gender imbalance in societies. So there's a link to an article on the website. And basically what this article is saying, and I'll just rummage through to find out the name of the author again, was Valerie Hudson, professor. Well, she's a professor at the Bush School of Government. That's got me worried now. And public service at Texas A&M University, and co-author of a book about Hillary doctrine, sex, and American foreign policy. Anyway, professor, School of Government, Texas University. And she's looking at the immigration in Europe and looking at the number of males who are coming across and entering into communities in Europe. And so she's done some calculations, and she's ignored adult males because she can't be sure if the adult male is going to bring in a female partner subsequently. So she sort of acknowledged that that can happen. What she's basically looked at is older teens in the sort of 16 to 17-year-old age bracket. And basically, of the immigrants, 90% of them are male. So young, strong men who are able to make the journey, that makes sense, in that age group, 90% are male. And in somewhere like Sweden, she says, My calculations show that there are now approximately 125 boys aged 16 to 17 for every 100 girls aged 16 to 17 in Sweden. So 125 to 100 is the imbalance. That is highly abnormal. It is significantly more abnormal than China, whose sex ratio for this group, due to the one-child policy, is 117 boys for every 100 girls aged 16 to 17. So in the article, she's making the point that in terms of immigration and assimilation, there's two issues. One is migrants are coming from different cultures and perhaps don't view women as equal to men. But just the second problem of this incredibly abnormal sex ratio, even if you had a completely homogenous society, but you had that sort of ratio going on, you would have significant social problems.
Yeah, it's phenomenal that they've set it up like that, well, that they've allowed this to happen.
Mm.
And it's the point that myself and Paul made last week when we were talking about Cologne. You know, there was. It appears that the decision to open the floodgates into Germany, which is the main one that the people are talking about, was in response to the fact that you had pictures of those distressing pictures of babies being washed up on the beach in Turkey.
Yep.
It was bloody awful that it happened, but the result has been that you've now got Norway as a government-run program teaching migrants how to treat women. It's amazing.
Mm.
And in Germany, the Cologne mayor calling on women to alter their behaviour around men. It's just amazing that Europe has turned its back on these issues that have not taken decades. They've taken centuries to achieve.
Yeah. So I think it was really interesting that even if all these people were Swedish, born, raised, for generations, if you had 125 males for every 100 girls, you'd have a massive social problem just on its own in terms of that imbalance. So I'd never heard of that argument before, and I found it a really interesting one.
Yeah, it is.
Still on the topic of the immigration issue then, Scott, there's a link to another article called The Folly of Mass Immigration. So while we're on the topic, we might as well talk about that article. And basically, have a read of it, but it's saying four things. So that the proponents of allowing this mass immigration would say that A, mass immigration is normal, and basically the article goes on to say that this sort of immigration has never happened before and is completely abnormal. And you've got to remember that in the past, until relatively recent times, say, up to 100 years ago, most people in the West rarely moved even to the next village. And now we've got whole villages from Bangladesh are relocating to northern England. People once, at the most, moved to their neighbouring country, which was often culturally and ethnically similar, whereas now they're moving around the world to radically different cultures with completely separate history and character. Basically saying there's no border controls until the 20th century because it wasn't needed. People didn't move except for the unusual immigration cases of the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, which were more or less empty lands built on immigration, which were the exception. Second point it makes, the one I really found interesting was pro-immigrationists are effectively trying to abolish nationhood, denying a country the right to sustain its own culture. And that this is working in only one way. So makes the point here, British-born white people, the progeny of the generation who survived the Nazi attempt to obliterate Britain as an independent nation state, now account for only 60% of the population of London. It's amazing, isn't it?
It's incredible.
Current trends continue, the historically indigenous population of Britain will become a minority by around 2100. So at the end of this century, the indigenous population of Britain, as we commonly recognise it, will be a minority. And the article makes this really interesting point that when we talk about small communities, we recognise a right for those communities to maintain their culture, and we see it as sacrosanct and a good thing that they are able to do that. People will defend the inalienable right of Palestinians, Tibetans, Native Americans to defend their culture. When it comes to the West doesn't seem to have that right. And it gives this example where the British government gave full UK passports to 200,000 people living in British overseas territories such as St Helena, Montserrat, the Turks and Caicos Islands. So the inhabitants were allowed to live in Britain, but there was no reciprocal right for British people to go and live in those other places. The justification for this one-sidedness was given in the House of Lords by the Foreign Office Minister, who said, "The right of abode is non-reciprocal. The territories which fall within the scope of the bill are for the most part small islands. In consultations on the content of the bill, the governments of the territories concerned made clear that granting British and European citizens the right of abode in their territories would risk fundamentally altering the social, cultural and economic fabric of those territories." Which it would. So the point is that Britain too is a small island, yet other British government ministers tell the British people that they must embrace mass immigration, and it's simply racist for British people to oppose the altering of their country's social, cultural and economic fabric.
It's absurd.
It's a very good point that the West is denied the right to maintain a culture, yet is... You know, the argument is made that other areas can, and it's important, but apparently it's not important if you're a wealthy Western country. So,
That's the whole point about this, you know, is that you've got a group of people coming in from a completely different background, completely different way of life. And they are turning the whole thing on its head.
Yes.
They are getting the host nation to do the changing, not changing themselves.
Yes. And by sheer dint of numbers. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm. You know, it's amazing. Like, you know, you see pictures of the East End in Britain, London's East End, and it's little Islamabad. Mm.
So,
you know.
So I thought that was an interesting one, that we, you know, we respect and we hold up, you know, the importance of culture for minority groups. Yet when it comes to the West, it doesn't seem that the same applies. So
that's certainly right.
So if you are interested in that thought, then there's a link to that article and well worth reading.
Yes, absolutely.
Scott.
Yes.
The quiz. just a couple.
Okay.
Jesus was in conflict with a type of tree. Can you name a tree that Jesus had a problem with?
An olive tree?
Well, not a bad guess.
Okay.
it was in fact a fig tree. And you see, I thought you might have got this because I'm going to be quoting from Matthew Scott, and as listeners will know, you have proved yourself to be something of a Matthew expert. Matthew 21, verses 18 to 20. Early in the morning, as Jesus was on his way back to the city, he was hungry. Seeing a fig tree by the road, he went up to it, but found nothing on it except leaves. Then he said to it, "May you never bear fruit again." Immediately the tree withered. When the disciples saw this, they were amazed. So the moral of that story is, if you're a fig tree or perhaps any fruit tree in the vicinity of Jesus and he's hungry, doesn't matter that you're out of season, you're just out of luck as well, because he's going to...
condemn you never to be.
He's going to curse you, and that's the end of it for you. So that's part of the moral guidance that we get from the Bible. So David, of David and Goliath fame, he was having an issue with Saul, and he wanted to marry King Saul's daughter, Michal, M-I-C-H-A-L, Michal, I'll say. And Saul said, well, what did Saul want as... not really as money for the bride, but as a payment for the bride. What did Saul want? What did he want David to present?
Gold?
No.
No. Okay. No, I don't know. Okay. Yeah.
Well, what he wanted was... it's quite... well, this would happen all the time. He wanted 100 Philistine foreskins, is what he wanted. And he thought that David, by attempting to kill 100 Philistines and whip off their foreskins, would perhaps meet his fate, because he didn't really want David to be successful. But lo and behold, David was so successful, he and his men went out and killed 200 Philistines and brought all their foreskins to Saul so that he could be the king's son-in-law. So the price for Michal, duly paid, was 200 Philistine foreskins. Scott?
Yeah, it's amazing that the Bible has got such a fascination with the male appendage, isn't it?
There's a lot in there, yes. So God has a thing with sex and genitals.
Yeah, exactly.
So he's, you know, requiring people to be circumcised and all the rest of it. But anyway, Saul wanted the foreskins, and he got them. So, I don't know, 200? Probably just a medium-sized bag. It wouldn't take up that much room. But so that's the quiz. Just those two, Scott, for this week.
Well, I'm pleased about that. So I didn't get any points this week.
No points. there's been something in America where a university teacher, professor, was claiming that Muslims and Christians are the same God, and people have been started to wearing heads... people who are not Muslim have begun wearing headscarves in solidarity with Muslim women. Scott?
Yeah, I read this, and I'm just a little bit surprised that people bothered. Well, not that they bothered, but that they got so upset that they felt that the only thing they could do was wear a headscarf. You know, it's the person that wrote this article, Nushin Arbarbazarbadar.
Yes.
She was from Afghanistan. Yep. And she said that in my life, headscarves have been a symbol of oppression, not solidarity.
Mm.
You know, and that's a damn good point, is that you're not asking any of the ex-Muslim women how they feel about it. You're just assuming that they're going to be patting you on the back for doing it. You know, it seemed to me a rather peculiar thing to get involved in.
Look, it's throughout the world, there are definitely many, many, many women who are forced to wear the veil when they don't want to. And sure, there are many women who voluntarily choose to wear the veil.
And, you know, I mean, there was an article you and I talked about a couple of weeks ago where we talked about a woman that her daughter had worn the veil before she did.
In that sort of hotbed in a U.S. state,
U.S. state, yes. Yeah.
Getting a more radicalized version of Islam than you would get back in the home country. But back to, you know, some women voluntarily wear the veil and many don't. And I think if you accept that there are millions of women who are forced to wear the veil when they don't want to, then you cannot wear the veil as a sign of support for women. Like, it just...
No.
If you accept the fact that there are people who are oppressed and are forced to wear that, you cannot wear the veil as a symbol of feminist support. It doesn't add up. So that's my view on that, but it's... the second group I mentioned who voluntarily wear the veil, you know what, I reckon so many are indoctrinated from such an early age that it's not truly a voluntary thing anyway. But that's an argument for another day.
Yeah, I agree. But no, I think you're right in that they are indoctrinated from such an early age that they figure that they have to wear it.
Yeah. Now, I'm really happy that Kevin Andrews is no longer our defence minister, Scott.
Yes.
So he's been out in the news saying that, you know, if he was still the Americans requested Australia to send more troops and wanting more boots on the ground. And Kevin Andrews said, well, if I was still defence minister, I would have said yes. And fortunately, the message we're getting from our Malcolm Turnbull and his current defence minister, Maurice Payne, is they're not inclined to do more. Like, I think they might have sent a few more in a support training role, but they're basically making it clear that's it. We're not putting boots on the ground. We've done more than we need to do. And I even heard today in the news Malcolm Turnbull currently meeting with the US president and making noises about we should be redefining the boundaries to more closely align with cultural and religious tribalism. And that's the first time I've heard that from somebody.
Well, and it's long overdue because, you know, you've said it before that, you know, it's the maps were drawn after the end of the First World War with no thought for, you know, Sunnis, Shia, or anything. It's just been, they just drew these lines on the map.
Just the French and the British carving up territory to suit themselves and
exactly.
And often actually carving up the territory knowing it's going to be a problem but thinking that's great, they'll just keep fighting amongst themselves and won't be able to fight us, like, you know, part of the theory. So, what they would do is carve up what they knew would be a disaster and then put the minority group in charge and say to the minority group, well, we'll help you out. You're going to have to work really hard to hold this whole powder keg together. And that was their method of control of these areas while they were pulling the oil out.
Yeah, agreed.
Scott, we've got a bunch of extra things on the list, but we are coming up to an hour, so I reckon we might hold off some of the others. Definitely next week, I'm going to talk. I've just finished a book, folks, about the Mormons, who have fascinated me for a long time. And this is by David Fitzgerald. And it was a really good read. Amazing, amazing sort of just... It's hard to believe that something so obviously fake and such a con could be as successful as it is, but
And that is the thing that's always amazed me about it.
The opening paragraph of this book is what got me in. He said, But if all of the major religions today held a competition to see which was the goofiest, most blatantly, most demonstrably well-documented pile of sheer, unflinching bullshit, who would win? It's a tough call, but in this little book, I'd like to make a heartfelt argument on behalf of the Church of Jesus Christ and the Latter-day Saints, a.k.a. the Mormons. And so that gives you a bit of a tone of the book, and I loved it, so... So I will try and provide a bit of a summary of the Mormons next week, because they're an interesting group, and they are.
Yeah, they are an interesting group.
They are just crazy. So, actually, one thing about the Mormons, just as a little sort of teaser for people, is, you know, like sort of famous for two things, the polygamy and also, you know, sending people off on... missions around the world to convert people. And did you know there was a connection between the two?
No, I didn't know that.
So Joseph Smith and others, as they were in charge of the church, basically they'd look around the town and see a rather attractive woman who they liked the look of, and if she was unfortunately already married, what they would simply do is say to her husband, have I got a job for you? You know, you need to go off on this mission to Africa for 4 years and convert people for us, and good luck, off you go, leaving the wife behind. And then they would tap the wife on the shoulder and say, well, we've got this thing of these secret marriages, and basically coerce and force them into a secret polygamous marriage. And yes, very successful. I mean, Joseph Smith ended up with 50 wives. And, you know, if you do that once or twice and you look around and you think, that's a good-looking woman over there. God damn, the husband's in the road. Just ship him off to a faraway country for a few years and problem solved.
Yeah, I find it amazing that, you know, I don't want to preempt it too much, but I find it incredible that you've got this situation that, you know, polygamy came about basically because he got busted having sex with his neighbour's wife.
Well, yeah. I mean, he just liked the idea of having multiple wives.
Yeah, exactly.
He liked the idea of playing around. And so anyway, there's a whole bunch of stuff. And the beauty about the Mormons is that because they're only 200 years old, they can't escape the history. So they want to say things didn't happen. But then, unfortunately, all of the documents to say that they happened exist and are there and prove them to be so crazy. And anyway, so that's a little teaser for next week, the Mormons, and a few of the other things that we've got on list, Scott. So I reckon we'll...
I think there's a couple of good ones that I think we should hold over to next
week. Yes, and I've got to find half an hour to work on my Sunday penalty rates argument. If anyone can help me out with that, send us a message.
You're still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Sorry, I just went silent.
Yeah, it did, but we're back. So, yes, if anyone can help me with my argument for Sunday trading, shoot us a message. Failing that, go on our website and see the instructions for leaving a positive review on iTunes. Like, if you're listening on iTunes right now, just tap a few things and give us a 5-star review. That would be really nice. And otherwise, Scott, I'll talk to you next week.
Absolutely. So thanks very much for tuning in, people. And we'll talk to you next week.
Bye, everyone.
Bye now.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone.
and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.